There is a terrible pestilence sweeping through the land. General Mungo St. John had selected a clay anthill as a rostrum from which to address his audience. It passes from one animal to the next, as a bushfire jumps from tree to tree. Unless we can contain it, all the cattle will die. Below the anthill, Sergeant Ezra was translating loudly, while the listening tribesmen squatted silently facing them. There were almost 2,000 of them, the occupants of all the villages that had been built along both banks of the Inyati River to replace the regimental kraals of Lobengula's Impi. The men were in the foremost ranks, their faces expressionless, but their eyes watchful. Behind them were the youths and boys not yet admitted to rank of warrior. These were the Mujiba, the herd boys, whose daily life was intimately interwoven with the herds of the tribe. The present Indaba concerned them as much as it did the elders. There were no women present, for it was a matter of cattle, of the nation's wealth. "It is a great sin to try to hide your cattle, as you have done, to drive them into the hills or the thick forest. These cattle carry with them the seeds of the pestilence," Mungo St. John explained, and waited for his sergeant to translate before going on. "Lodzi and I are very angry with these deceptions. There will be heavy fines for those villages which hide their cattle. And as further punishment, I will double the work quotas for the men, so that you will work like Amaholi, like slaves you will toil if you attempt to defy the word of Lodzi." Mungo St. John paused again, and lifted the black eye patch to wipe away the sweat that trickled down from under the wide-brimmed slouch hat. Drawn by the lowing herds in the thornbush kraal, the big shiny green flies swarmed, and the place stank of cow dung and unwashed humanity. Mungo found himself impatient with the necessity of trying to explain his actions to the silent, unresponsive throng of half-naked savages, for he had already repeated the same warning at 30 other Indabas across Matabele land. His sergeant finished the translation and glanced up at him expectantly. Mungo St. John pointed to the mass of cattle penned in the thorn kraal behind him. "As you have seen, it is of no avail to try to hide the herds. The native police track them down." Mungo stopped again and frowned in annoyance. In the second row, a Matabele buck had risen and was facing him quietly. He was a tall man, finely muscled, although one arm seemed deformed, for it was twisted from the shoulder at an awkward angle. Though the body was that of a man in his full prime, the face was eroded and ravaged, as though by grief or pain, and was aged before its time. On the neat cap of dense curls, the man wore the head ring of an Induna, and around his forehead a headband of grey fur. "Baba, my father," said the Induna, "we hear your words, but like children we do not understand them." "Who is this fellow?" Mungo demanded of Sergeant Ezra, and nodded when he heard the reply. "I know about him. He is a troublemaker." Then to Butso, raising his voice, "What is so strange about what I say? What is it that puzzles you?" "You say, Baba, that this sickness will kill the cattle. So before it does, you will shoot them dead. You say, Baba, you say that, to save our cattle, you must kill them for us." The quiet ranks of Matabele stirred for the first time. Though their expressions were still impassive, here a man coughed, and there another shuffled his bare feet in the dust, or yet another flicked his switch at the circling flies. No man laughed. Not one mocked with word or smile. But it was mockery nonetheless, and Mungo St. John sensed it. Behind those inscrutable black African faces, they were gleefully following the mock humble questions of the young Induna with the old worn face. "We do not understand such deep wisdom, Baba. Please be kind and patient with your children and explain it to us. You say that if we try to hide our cattle, then you will confiscate them from us to pay the heavy fines that Lodzi demands. You say in the same breath, Baba, that if we are obedient children and bring the cattle to you, then you will shoot them and burn them up." In the packed ranks, an elderly whitebeard, who had taken snuff, sneezed loudly, and there was immediately an epidemic of sneezing and coughing. Mungo St. John knew they were encouraging the young Induna in this sly impudence. "Baba, gentle father, you warn us that you will double our work quotas and we will be as slaves. This is another matter which escapes from us, for is a man who works one day at another's command less a slave than he who works 2 days? Is not a slave merely a slave? And is not a free man truly free? Baba, explain to us the degrees of slavery. There was a faint humming sound now, like the sound of a hive at noon, and though the lips of the Matabili facing Mungo St. John did not move, he saw that their throats trembled slightly. They were beginning to drum. It was the prelude, and, unchecked, it would be followed by the deep ringing gee, gee of the chant. "I know you, Batso," Mungo St. John shouted. "I hear and mark your words. Be sure that Lodzi also will hear them." "I am honoured, little father, that my humble words will be carried to the great white father, Lodzi." This time there were cunning and wicked grins on the faces of the men around Batso. "Sergeant," Mungo St. John shouted, "bring that man to me!" The big sergeant leapt forward with the brass badge of his rank glittering on his upper arm. But as he did so, the ranks of silent Matabili rose to their feet and closed up. No man raised a hand, but the sergeant's forward rush was smothered, and he struggled in the crowd as though in living black quicksand. And when he reached the place where Batso had been, the Induna was gone. "Very well," Mungo St. John nodded grimly when the sergeant reported back to him. "Let him go. It'll wait for another day. But now we have work to do. Get your men into position." A dozen armed black police trotted forward and formed a line facing the throng of tribesmen, holding their rifles at high port. At the same time, the rest of the contingent climbed up onto the thorny walls of the kraal, and at the command, they pumped cartridges into the breeches of the repeating Winchester rifles. "Let it begin," Mungo nodded. And the first volley of rifle fire thundered out. The black constables were firing down into the milling mass of the cattle in the kraal, and at each shot a beast would fling its horned head high and collapse, to be hidden at once by the others. The smell of fresh blood maddened the herd, and it surged wildly against the thorn barrier. The din of the blood bellow was deafening, and from the ranks of watching Matabili went up a mourning howl of sympathy. These animals were their wealth, and their very reason for existence. As Mujiba, they had attended the birthings in the felt, and helped to beat off the hyena and the other predators. They knew each animal by name and loved them with that special type of love that will make the pastoral man lay down his own life to protect his herds. In the front rank was a warrior so old that his legs were thin as those of the marabou stalk, and whose skin was the colour of a tobacco pouch and puckered in a network of fine wrinkles. It seemed there was no moisture left in his dried-out ancient frame, and yet fat, heavy tears rolled down his withered cheeks as he watched the cattle shot down. The crash of rifle fire went on until sunset, and when at last it was silent, the kraal was filled with carcasses. They lay upon each other in deep windrows, like the wheat after the scythes have passed. Not a single Matabili had left the scene. They watched in silence now, their mourning long ago silenced. "The carcasses must be burned," Mungo St. John strode down the front rank of warriors. "I want the carcasses covered with wood. No man is spared this labour, neither the sick nor the old. Every man will wield an axe, and when they are covered, I will put the fire to it myself." "What is the mood of the people?" Batso asked softly, and Babian, the senior of all the old king's councillors, answered him. It was not lost on the others in the packed beehive thatched hut that Babian's tone was respectful. "They are sick with grief," said Babian. "Not since the death of the old king has there been such despair in their hearts as now that the cattle are being killed."
"It is almost as though the white men wish to plunge the assegai into their own breast," Batso nodded. "Each cruel deed strengthens us and confirms the prophecy of the Unlimo. Can there be one amongst you who still has doubts?"
"There are no doubts.
We are ready now," replied Gundang, his father. And yet he also looked to Batso for confirmation and waited for his reply.
"We are not ready," Batso shook his head. "We will not be ready until the third prophecy of the Amlimo has come to pass.
When the hornless cattle are eaten up by the cross." Somabula whispered this.
We saw the cattle destroyed today, those that the pestilence has spared. That is not the prophecy, Batso told them. When it comes, there will be no doubt in our minds. Until that time, we must continue with the preparations. What is the number of the spears, and where are they held? One by one, the other indunas stood, and each made his report. They listened and listed the numbers of warriors that were trained and ready, where each group was situated, and how soon they could be armed and in the field. When the last one had finished, Batso went through the form of consulting the senior indunas, and then gave the field commanders their objectives. Suku Induna of the Imbezu Impi, your men will sweep the road from the Malundi Drift southwards to Gwanda Mine. Kill anybody you find upon the road. Cut the copper wires at each pole. The Amadoda working at the mine will be ready to join you when you reach there. There are 28 whites at Gwanda, including the women and the family at the trading post. Afterwards, count the bodies to make certain that none have escaped. Suku repeated the orders, word perfectly, displaying the phenomenal recall of the illiterate who cannot rely on written notes, and Batso nodded and turned to the next commander to give him his instructions and to hear them recited back to him. It was long after midnight before all of them had received and repeated their orders, and then Batso addressed them again. Stealth and speed are our only allies. No warrior will carry a shield, for the temptation to drum upon it in the old way would be too strong. Steel alone. Silent steel. There will be no singing in the war songs when you run, for the leopard does not growl before he springs. The leopard hunts in darkness, and when he enters the goat shed, he spares nothing. As easily as he rips the throat from the billy, he kills also the nanny and the kids.
Women, asked Babian somberly.
Even as they shot down Ruth and Imbali, Batso nodded.
Children? Asked another Induna.
Little white girls grow up to bear little white boys, and little white boys in their turn grow up to carry guns. When a wise man finds a mamba's lair, he kills the snakes and crushes the eggs underfoot.
Will we spare none?
None, Batso confirmed quietly. But there was something in his voice that made Gundung his father shiver. He recognized the moment when the real power shifted from the old bull to the younger. Indisputably, Batso was now their leader. So it was Batso who said at last, Indaba Pelile, the meeting is finished. And one by one the Indunas saluted him and left the hut and slipped away into the night. And when the last was gone, the screen of goatskins at the back was pushed aside. And Tanasi stepped out and came to Batso.
I am so proud, she whispered, that I want to weep like a silly girl.
It was a long column, counting the women and children, almost 1,000 human beings. It was strung out over a mile, winding like a maimed adder down out of the hills. Again, custom was being flouted. For although the men led, they were burdened with grain bags and cooking pots. Of old, they would have carried only their shields and weapons. There were more than the 200 strong men that Batso had promised Henshaw. The women came after them. Many of the men had brought more than one wife, and some as many as four. Even the very young girls, those not yet in puberty, carried rolls of sleeping mats balanced upon their heads, and the mothers had their infants slung upon their hips, so that they could suckle from a fat black breast while on the march. Juba's roll of matting was as heavy as any of them. However, despite her great bulk, the younger woman had to step out to keep pace with her. Her high, clear soprano led the singing. Batso came back along the column at an easy lope. Unmarried girls turned their heads, careful not to unbalance their burdens, to watch him as he passed, and then they whispered and giggled amongst themselves. For though he was ravaged and scarred, the aura of power and purpose that surrounded him was intensely attractive to even the youngest and flightiest of them. Batso came level with Juba and fell in at her side. Mama Wetu, he greeted her respectfully. The burdens of your young girls will be a little lighter after we cross the river. We will leave 300 assegais concealed in the millet bins and buried under the goat shed of Suku's people.
And the rest of them?
Juba asked.
Those we will take with us to the Harkness mine. A place of concealment has been prepared. From there your girls will take them, a few at a time, to the outlying villages.